Con, you ready? All right, we are going to convene the Monday, March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, 2014, policy meeting of the Transportation Public Safety Committee. We don't quite yet have a quorum, but we'll go ahead and start the first bill presentation from Senator Nienau and just wait for folks to arrive. I know that it's deadline week and folks are kind of scattered around the building presenting bills and in other committees. So hopefully we'll get a quorum very soon, because I know Senator Nienau has an amendment that we'll need to act upon.
Thank
Welcome
you, Mr.
to the
Chair.
Committee, Senator.
Yes, and I did speak with Senator Osmond beforehand. He's willing to move the amendment if no one else does, but until we have a quorum, obviously you can't do that. Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 2035 would name a section of highway in southern Chisago County, Highway 8, the Nicholas Patrick Spehar Memorial Highway. I do have a couple of gentlemen that will speak a little bit and give more of a personal touch on this, but Navy Special Warfare Operator Petty Officer Second Class Nicholas P. Spehar was a Navy SEAL. He was killed August 6, 2011, serving during Operation Enduring Freedom. Many of you probably remember the news story of that particular event. It was a Chinook helicopter that was struck by a rocket-propelled grenade, and 30 military service members were killed in that accident. Nicholas Spehar was one of the SEALs. He was a West Coast-based SEAL team. His was a West Coast-based SEAL team. He graduated Chisago Lakes High School in 2005. He enlisted, I believe, in 2007. And a few of, well, I'll just read his decorations, Mr. Chair. They include the Army Commendation Medal, two Navy and Marine Corps Achievement Medals, National Defense Service Medal, Iraq Campaign Medal, the Global War on Terrorism Expeditionary Medal, the Global War on Terrorism Service Medal, Good Conduct Medal, Sea Service Deployment Ribbon, Rifle Marksmanship Medal, and a Pistol Marksmanship Medal. Mr. Chair, I do have Andy Wilkerson, who is a friend of the family, and also Commissioner George Larson stuck in my head. It's from Isani County. George McMahon, he is not representing the county, but he is representing from the perspective of veterans.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself. And then
For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Andy Wilkerson. I am a resident of Chisago City, Minnesota. Senator, thank you for seeing me today. By trade, folks, I'm a salesperson. And so I guess I tell stories for a living. And I'd like to tell you a little bit, a story of a life about a young man who was very, very, very impressive to me. And basically our community holds in our hearts to this day. Before I start, also, I heard something on the news this weekend about a throwaway generation talking about these 20-year-old kids and everything, the 20-year-old generation, and this young man was part of that, and I'll let you make your own decisions about throwaway generations. I first met Nick Spehar when he was 7 years old. I was the t-ball coach of my son's t-ball team, and Nick was a member of it along with his younger brother, Luke. Nick was kind of a sponge. He everything you showed him, he wrapped his arms around it and excelled at it. He was a good kid. You could look at him and just tell that, okay, this is going to be a pretty grounded individual when he gets older. His family upbringing, quite honestly, had a lot to do with what I just told you. His family is what I call a cornerstone family of our community. He has two sisters and two other brothers. His parents, basically, they did everything together as a family, and they excelled. They were volunteers in our community. They were tremendously involved in their church. Scholastically, they achieved everything you could possibly want out of students. And also, the kids were all involved in extracurricular activities, theater, choir, band, and all sorts of sports. The boys also were excellent outdoorsmen. As a father and a coach and a friend, I take a lot of enjoyment out of watching our young people in the Chisago Lakes area grow up. I like to think I molded a couple of them, or at least helped mold a couple of them. I would occasionally see Nick, and as I stated, I was very proud to see the young man that he had grown into. He was kind and conscientious. He always had a smile on his face, a slap on his back, or a hug for you. My neighbor, Terry Willem, shared a story that when he was roofing his home, Nick was riding by on his bicycle. He was maybe 15, 16 years old. And he saw that Terry was struggling with these 20 squares of shingles that he was trying to put up on his roof. And he went over and he loaded every one of those shingles on that roof for that man. And he wouldn't take a penny for it. He basically said, you know, that's just the neighborly thing to do, and that's the way I was brought up. Nick had a lot of opportunities after high school. As stated, he graduated in 2005. He was accepted at several major universities, but in the end, he chose to serve his nation. He joined the United States Navy in 2007. He excelled in service and eventually qualified for SEAL team training at the age of 21 years old. I'm sure many of you have heard about what it takes to become a Navy SEAL. It is the most stringent training that any of our service branches have to offer. Nick made it through on his first try. And I'll just tell you a short story in regards to Hell Week, which is absolutely the worst week that you can possibly go through in your life if you're a Navy SEAL. He called his folks, and he asked that they gather around the kitchen table with his sisters and his brothers and his brother-in-law. And he said, whatever is troubling you today, whatever tugs at your heart, would you please give it to me right now? Give it to me, and let me take it to Hell Week this week, and I'll leave it there for you. This from a 21-year-old young man. This from a throwaway generation, supposedly. He enjoyed the camaraderie and the true meaning of team and the brotherhood that the SEALs had to offer. And like I said, he made it through on his first try. He was assigned to SEAL Team 5, which was a West Coast SEAL team. And we all heard in the community that he had become a SEAL. None of us were surprised, but a lot of us were very proud. He had deployments to the Philippines and to Yemen in support of Operation Enduring Freedom. And upon completion of his second deployment, he volunteered for Afghanistan. In May of 2011, as many of you know, the U.S. caught up with Osama bin Laden, and he was dealt with by a SEAL team. I took great satisfaction in the fact that we had a SEAL from our community and that fellow SEALs that he probably knew had dealt with the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. Coincidentally, that same May, many of us saw Nick at his sister Lisa's graduation from Chisago Lakes High School. And unfortunately, that would be the last time we ever saw him. Flash forward 2 months to August 6th in 2011, and news started coming in about that Chinook helicopter carrying 30 U.S. service personnel, 7 Afghan commandos, and 1 Afghan interpreter. It had been shot down in Wardak province in Afghanistan. Then on the 7th, it was confirmed that it was a 25-member SEAL team, 5 Army National Guardsmen, and later on in the day, we learned that there were 2 Minnesotans on board that helicopter. SEAL team member John Foss of Minneapolis and SEAL team member Nicholas Spihar of Chisago Lakes. Nick was survived by his parents, Patrick and Annette, his sisters, Marie and Lisa, and his brothers, Luke and Jacob, and his brother-in-law. On the 19th of August, 2011, our country buried a hero right down the street from here. Some of you were probably at that funeral. In the weeks that followed the funeral, many of Nick's classmates and friends asked what we could do to honor him. Name something at the high school, possibly plant a couple of trees at our community square. There were a lot of different ideas. But eventually, life returned to normal, and talk of the memorial subsided. And I'm going to tell you, that's probably the best thing that could have happened to our community, because it gave time to heal. And time does heal a lot of wounds. Nick is memorialized at the Chisago County Veterans Memorial, his name amongst others that gave their lives in service in the history of our wars and also members of our community. Nick also has a full scholarship named after him at Holy Cross University in Notre Dame, Indiana. It is dedicated to children of vets. In the spring of 2013, I was driving on Interstate 35 northbound, and I saw a DOT truck washing a road sign off. The sign was dedicated to Officer Sean Silvera, the Lionel Lakes police officer that gave his life in the line of duty. That sign sparked this idea that we bring before you today. This young man's sacrifice has touched all of our hearts. Why not dedicate a road that runs through the heart of our community that gave him to our country, the communities that gave him to our country? It gives us a chance to tell his story. It gives us a chance to be his witness. And in closing, you've heard me mention the word team a couple of times in this message. When I brought this idea to the Spehar family, they all got together to discuss and basically, you know, throw the idea around. I didn't want to push it unless they were on board with this. I was very happy to receive a call back from Pat, Nick's father, and he said wholeheartedly, our family supports this, and more importantly, Andy, we think Nick would like this. And I asked him why Nick would like this. And he said, two reasons. Number one, it runs through the heart of our communities. It touches the three towns that he loved the most in his life. And secondly, by honoring Nick, you honor his team, you honor his comrades, and in the end, the ones that he died with. Many thanks to Senator Nenow and Representative Barrett, Mr. McMahon, but most importantly, thanks to the Spehars for allowing me to share this story about their son with them, with all of you. I thank you for the time, Mr. Commissioner and Senators. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkerson. You represent Nick Spehar and the community and his family very well. I appreciate those thoughts and those sentiments. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, there's not much I can say after Andy and what he had to say about the family and about this individual.
Can you please introduce yourself just for the record?
My name is George McMahon. I live in Chisago City, also the vice commander of the American Legion Post 272 in Chisago City. I represent the Veterans Memorial Committee, which represents the city, the Legion Post 83 in Lindstrom, 272 in Chisago City, and VFW Post 7672 in Lindstrom. And when Andy came to us with this idea, we supported it 100% because we were all, as Andy said before, we were trying to, how can we and what can we do for this individual? We live in a small community, which is a large, small community, I guess. We know everyone, and everyone knew the family. The portion of the road goes right through the middle of my commissioner district, which is Lindstrom, Chisago City, and Center City. And this is, hope you can support this. Again, there's not much I can say after Andy. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Commissioner McMahon. Senator Nenow.
Mr. Chair, well, if the committee would be willing to entertain the A1 amendment.
Yes, the quorum is present. There's an amendment to be offered. Senator Osmick moves the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, if I would just explain what it's just a technical change as to the geographic location of the section of highway. This change, if the committee were to adopt it, merely takes the section of highway. It's a contiguous area from the western border of Chisago City through Lindstrom to the eastern border of Center City. It's just a slight shift to the east, essentially, if you're looking at a map.
Great. All right. Questions, members? All in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Senator Nenow, did you want, I assume you had determined not to include Mr. Spehar's rank. You just wanted his name, is that correct? Just wanted to check on that.
Mr. Chair, my House member actually had this piece of legislation drafted. I was not involved in the drafting, so I do not know the discussions that were involved in
all right.
That. If that is standard protocol for these memorial highways, I don't know that there would be any opposition to that.
Okay. Well, we can make that fix later. Do you want to figure that out, and we'll figure it out on the floor or somewhere else? All right.
Certainly, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thanks. All right. Senator Kiffenbrock.
I'd like to make the motion to...
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to recommend that Senate File 2035 be recommended to be passed and...
As amended.
As amended, and be placed on the general orders, or does it go to another committee, Mr. Chair?
I think just on the Senate floor, yeah.
On the Senate floor.
All right. Very good. Questions, members? All right. Well, thank you very much for telling us about Nick and his service to our country, and please carry our regards and our thanks back to his family and tell them that we're pleased to be able to do this very minimal honor for him. And
thank you
and
much,
them.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Thank you for your time.
All right. Senator Sexhog is here. I saw him. There he is. Senate File 1787. Permits. This is our vehicle for overweight trucks. Legislation. No, I'm just kidding.
Jeez.
Senator Sexhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today we're presenting 1787. This bill requires a variety of permits to renew on the same date as the plate registration is renewed. It is aimed at making things simpler. It's perfect for the uncession, and particularly for small business. Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment, which changes, maybe we'll pass it out and then I'll explain it.
All right, thank you. Senator Kent will move the A1 amendment. It's an author's amendment, so why don't we go ahead and vote on it, and then you can explain the bill in light of the changes. Thank you. Questions to the A1 amendment members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Senator Sacksock.
As I explained the bill, or at least described it in two sentences, we have been in discussion with the Department of Transportation and the A1 amendment. What it does is change the effective date to November 2016, and that's so they can have time to make the changes that are necessary to get this done on a smooth basis. It also makes the requirement optional at the request of the permit holder. What I think we're trying to do here, of course, is help the small logger, the small businessmen, the large contractors are probably equipped to do this, and may not benefit them as much. So with me today, Mr. Chair and members, is Wayne Brandt from the Minnesota Forest Industries to explain how he sees the bill and answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator Sacksog. Mr. Brandt, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for the record, Wayne Brandt with the Minnesota Timber Producers Association today. I have two groups. Timber Producers Association members are loggers, truckers, small sawmills, allied businesses. And this is an issue that came directly from my members out in the woods that brought up several times. It would be a lot simpler for us if the various permits that we have to obtain came due at the same time as the license plates did, as the vehicle registration did. So this bill seeks to do that. You'll see a variety of clauses in the bill which pertain to seasonal weights, to forest products provisions, to provisions for agricultural products, and one for canola. And so what this would do is allow those permits to all renew on the same date. For a small business owner, with three or four trucks and licenses and three or four permits for each truck instead of us interacting with the licensing and permitting folks, three, four, five, six, eight times a year, 12 times a year, whatever it may be. It would get that down to really one per vehicle. Be a significant simplification for us, for the farmers, and we think for the DOT and the various permit issuers. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Brandt. Questions, members? Senator Reiner.
Question for you, Mr. Chair. I have this vague recollection of having a very similar conversation last session. Am I imagining that?
We had a similar conversation. I can't remember exactly what that was about.
You know what it was? I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. It was commerce. We were trying to line up some renewal periods. So similar issue.
Right.
To make it a little less onerous for the small businesses.
Right. All right, I'm going to ask the Department of Transportation to come to the table and let us know if this works for them or not, or if it triggers a fiscal note or not, if we need to send it to finance or not. Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Scott Peterson from MnDOT, and we appreciate Senator Sachs-Hogg bringing this amendment. Basically, what the amendment does is allows us to wait until the Division of Vehicle Services MNLAR system is developed so that we can establish a software connection between our permitting system and their system in order to make this work efficiently. And so it would definitely have a beneficial impact on the fiscal note.
All right. So I heard fiscal note. Do we need to consider this in the context of the Finance Committee, Mr. Peterson?
It would be an additional requirement, and there would be a cost to develop the software thing. I don't know if it's pushing it out to – I'm not sure what year we would undertake the work to get this implemented, but at some point in the future there would be.
All right. So why don't we send it to Finance, that way we'll be clear of our deadlines so that won't trigger any – anxiety, Senator Sachs-Hogg, I hope. Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair, that should be fine.
All right. Just so we're clear, we're doing our due diligence. Very good. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question about the bill itself.
All right. Very good.
Is it okay?
Yep.
All right. In regards to, it says it's in the summary here that it's changing the expiration date for certain overweight vehicle permits. Either you or Ms. Bereshofsky could also answer this question, is what is not included in this? Since it's certain who are, there must be uncertain others.
Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer and probably Mr. Brandt or the Senator could correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we limited it to annual permits and not permits for a shorter duration.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Very good. All right. Any further questions, members? Would anyone else like to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Senator Kent. Seemed to be my motion maker today. Unless
you.
Anyone else is dying to make this motion. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that Senate file number 1787 as amended be passed and referred to Transportation Finance.
Full Finance.
Yep.
Great. Thank you. Any questions on the motion or the bill? All in favor, Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was that full Finance, Senator Cohen, or?
Oh, all bills go to Finance, and then they get referred to Division.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that's how that happens. All right, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you, Senator Sachs.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
All right, moving along. I think Senator Jensen. Senate file 2372. So, Senator Jensen, I believe it's only a couple of sections that bring this bill here. Section 12 and 2. So, That's what we'll hear about. Section 2 and 12 of Senate File 2372. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is Senate File 2372. This was an effort that was undertaken by a large group of people and included 11 legislators that met over the interim. We were looking at insurance fraud prevention. And I have with me Senator Kent, who participated in the working group and took on the Section 12 that you're referring to that deals with taking a look at and reviewing the approaches that we might take when it comes to insurance coverage verification and people that don't have proof of their insurance. So I'd like to turn it over now to Senator Kent so she can describe that section of the bill.
Great. Thank you, Senator Jensen. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, it was a pleasure to serve on this committee during the interim and dive into some areas that were relatively new to me. And when we started talking about the issue of vehicle insurance and proof of insurance, people started talking about software and electronic verifications systems. And I said, wait a minute, we know something about MNLARS, so I figured I'd help be a part of that conversation.
Members, so we're looking at Section 12. It starts on page 8, just reference. Thanks.
So as we were having the conversation about the issue of the current statute in Minnesota with insurance coverage for motorists, the mandatory coverage, and what has happened over roughly the past 10 years in terms of systems sort of unwinding a little bit, It just seemed like a good time to take a look at current statute, what our options are, and what, if we wanted to try to have a more aggressive effort at proof of insurance, what new technology provides. Many states are taking this on around the country, and there's a lot of new information that's available out there. So we tried to create a task force that brought in a wide range of stakeholders to do a real sort of blank slate look at it. We tried to be pretty non-prescriptive about it and ask this group to go out and take a look at the situation. There's a huge range. We don't even know really how many motorists in Minnesota do not have insurance right now. We don't know the scope of the situation. We don't know the scope of what that means for Minnesota consumers. And then to get out there and find out what the different options are. And so that is basically what this calls for. We also recognize that there was some interest in trying to hurry this up, and we recognize that with the ongoing situation with MNLARS that we weren't going to be able to cost-effectively make any changes anytime soon. So this seemed a moment in which we could take a deep breath, do a good, responsible analysis, and come back with some answers and some recommendations.
All right. Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Peterson.
So, Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, do you anticipate a fiscal note on this particular bill? It seems like we're creating this task force. Is there a cost associated with that that you're aware of? Or?
Senators Kent or Jensen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, I believe that there would be an impact and that we are requesting a fiscal note. That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So I do know, Senator Peterson, that this goes next to Judiciary, and then I'm assuming it has to go to state and local at some point.
I think next stop is state and local.
Oh, okay. I have Judiciary here. All right. We'll change that. And at some point, I'm sure it'll swing through finance. Senator Reinert.
Thank you, Chair Dibble. And I would just share with transportation members that Commerce had a lengthy hearing on this. This was a top Commerce priority during the interim. So Senators Kent and Jensen and others really did a ton of work on this to get it to Commerce. So there's been a lot of eyes on this.
Great. Thank you. Questions on Section 12? Did I see your hand, Senator Sender? Senator Sender.
This brings back memories. About 5 years ago, was maybe the poster child on a situation like this. seemingly almost being insurance poor and having, you know, all the insurance, but yet when checked against the state system, I didn't have insurance, and had I been stopped for any reason, why, at that point in time, I would have not been able to drive my car off I-94 or anyplace else. And as we went through all that, and it did get a little publicity, I found out that there were soldiers in Iraq that were paying insurance, but they hadn't completed the forms and got them in. This is a real entangled kind of effort. It's going to be really difficult, I think, to make all this work. Hopefully, the task force can. But the more you get into it, the more complicated it gets, and just trying to keep track of everyone's lives, literally, in terms of where they are and what their postal address is, and so on and so forth. We live in a fairly mobile society, and my experience, which was pretty heavy in this at the time, was one that would simply, again, if I haven't said it, suggest that making this work is not easy.
Senator, that was the random sample days, right?
Right.
Yeah. I was in those hearings. I remember you're a tiny bit annoyed, just a little bit.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, yes, when this has been discussed and some of the history of how this issue has evolved over or devolved, really, over the years, your case study does come up in conversation. and it is in recognition that after that happened and it revealed a bunch of problems, that people have realized that the system that we had in place was not effective. And so that's why it's been continually sort of curtailed to where we are now. And the good news is technology, I often reference, there's a Geico commercial with the pig at the DVS office with his phone with his proof of insurance. You know, I mean, technology is changing, and hopefully there are some solutions in there that will solve the problems that you encountered.
Great, thanks. Other questions, members? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And I would like to point out and compliment Senator Jensen. You'll see that the task force does sunset at the day after that the report is issued, and I think it's a great example for your colleagues. If they have legislation that's creating a task force, it's a great example to follow to have a sunset on that particular task force, and let them come back to the legislature if for whatever reason they feel like they need to continue for some reason, that it be reevaluated. And I wanted to compliment you on having that sunset in there. It's a great example for all of us.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions on Section 12? All right. Senator Jensen, do you want to go over Section 2?
Sure. Section 2 deals with what we were taking a look at is information when you are in an accident in the state of Minnesota is considered public data. Our working group talked about and discussed some of the solicitation that comes after that. And what this bill does is it says that that data is not considered public until 90 days after the incident, or the day of the creation of the data.
All right. Questions, members? All right. 1 second. So we're just figuring out the referral path, because usually the CAs are in close contact with each other and figuring out the route.
Okay.
For the bills. Did you know that it needs to go to state and local before judiciary? Do you have a path cleared with the
What I've understood that the path would be.
All right.
Is it would have to pass out of here, go to state and local, and to judiciary.
Okay.
And I'm not sure if that's because of a timing of state and local when they meet.
Okay. All right. Well, if that's what you've figured out, then we will go on that path. All right. Anything further, members? Nope. Okay. Mr. Carlson, I was just going to call for public testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
whichever of you would like to go first.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman, on A, just to follow up Senator Kent's comments and to indicate the need and the importance for us to study in Minnesota. The Fraud Task Force did spend some considerable time looking at the uninsured motorist issue in Minnesota, and it's been an issue that we have been involved with many legislative discussions on. And frankly, we can just do better in Minnesota than we're doing. So I think a focused look, taking the time, and as Senator Kent commented, looking at the technology available today, there is technology available. States are looking at this. And obviously, we'll need to work with the department and with their upgrading their systems. So it's getting the systems to talk to each other. I know it's been an issue that we have talked a lot about over the years, but we believe it's an important process and are committed to it, Mr. Chairman. On
right.
Section 2, I just want to underscore the importance. I know as Senator Reinhart has indicated that the Senate Commerce Committee had a two-hour hearing on this bill the other day. And just to support strongly, this was one of the issues that the committee looked at. In other words, what's happening in Minnesota in our system and laws that's the generator of the amounts of fraud that we're seeing. And that's no fault auto was a system of particular focus, but it's across the board in terms of insurance systems. And it's and the point of this is that its impact is on consumers. There is a negative impact of fraud, and it's impacting family budgets in this state. To the tune of probably $1,000 or more per year in premiums and higher cost of goods and services. So it's significant. No-fault auto is a focus of the task force. And this section, Mr. Chairman, we think is a very important law change to deal with. And we actually think it's kind of one of the gateways or one of the entrances that the fraudsters are coming in. And if you've heard the phrase runners and cappers, this is individuals that chase other individuals to get them into providers. It's actually illegal, and it's a criminal act under the Minnesota Criminal Code. But these accident reports, which in another statute, they're confidential except for a statute that makes them public. And with the names and addresses that are sold, I think everybody in the room knows someone whose mailbox has been filled up with letters days after an accident report is filed. And I brought a stack of them to the hearing the other day that had just come in a couple days before the hearing from a friend. So we think that this is the bill as it comes before you. The task force actually recommended even stronger language than was put in the bill, but I think through some stakeholder input, we think that this is a limitation that's appropriate, that it puts the pause, if you will, on the sale, and then the hustling that happens once it goes out. And it's really let the consumers make their decisions on who they want to go to providers and make those choices. And so, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we think this is a reasonable change from the current law and would strongly support its passage. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Johnson, Mr. Carlson.
Oh, sorry. Just you.
I don't know if I'm up to the yelling today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, which is an association of professional attorneys that represent people who are injured through other people's negligence, and many of those are through automobile accidents. And no group, I don't think, has complained louder or longer about the lack of insurance verification in Minnesota and the impact that that has on the driving public. And so we're not opposed at all to the Section 12 of the bill, although I would note with some good humor that of all the groups that are represented, none happen to be those that are attorneys like the ones I represent that are that represent consumers that have actually been injured. You've got ARP, AAA, Insurance Federation, Bankers, Bar Association, Chiefs of Police. There's not a single consumer advocate on this particular group, and I only point that out because I don't think that that is intended in my many discussions with Senator Kent. But we have long, from the time of Senator Senjum's near revocation of his driving privileges, we have complained about this loudly and hope that it is at some point fixed. Mr. Chairman and members, I want to not gloss over the change that was made in the Senate Judiciary Committee in Section 2, which I believe is a dramatic and radical change in public policy as it relates to the public's access to police records. What this language says in Section 2 is that no one, the media, your local Crime Stoppers, an automobile accident victim, no one can get access to a police-generated data from law enforcement until 90 days after the government decides to say they've generated that report. And I can tell you that that, unintended or not, is a dramatic shift in Minnesota's openness in government. And I understand that there is an allegation that, some people may misuse accident reports for nefarious reasons, and I think that should be stopped. But to take this approach to deny everyone's access to police records, whether it's crime going on in your neighborhood or an automobile accident or a dangerous intersection, to deny the public access to this information, we think just goes way too far. Let's address the fraud. If someone is actually using these accident records in an improper way, bring them to justice, convict them, but do not restrict everyone else's legitimate right to know this information. This is not private information on individuals. This, as you can see on line 1.24, is public data. We have a right to know. You know, if you couldn't get any information from the time the police decided to file a police report, high-profile accident case, the Amy Sensor case, you would have outrage. You'd have outrage if you didn't have the ability to get access to that police report. And that's what I fear is happening here with this language, 90 days after the data was created or collected. And whether that's 10 days after the accident they create the report or how they define collected, this is a huge deviation from our existing policy on data practices, and we strongly have concerns about it. The other thing that I would point out, and I know Senator Kent's got a bill on this, and in the insurance industry is actively talking about the bulk sale of public data and non-public data. Senator Kent's bill deals with non-public data that is sold to the insurance industry. This is public data that is sold to individuals. And that debate, if you restrict that in a way as it is contained here, I would submit to you that most people wouldn't buy it. And I think that has a significant implication. It pales in comparison, Senator Peterson, to the cost of the task force if you're not going to allow the Department of Public Safety to bundle and sell these accident records in bulk. That's going to have a significant financial implication to the department, far in excess of the cost of this task force. So I would urge caution on this language as it moves forward, because I don't think that this is the intent. Get after the fraud, dedicate more resources to fraud prevention, get after a provider that's improperly using that record. But don't restrict a consumer's right to get that information or the public's right. Just think of an alcohol-related arrest. You have an implied consent hearing that has to happen within 30 days. If I can't get information about my case or my representation until after 90 days, that information is useless to me at that point. I don't think that's what your intent is, but that is clearly what this language would do. And I think it needs serious, serious work to make that appropriate for the fraud that they're trying to prevent. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'd be happy to answer questions. I spent my summer on the fraud task force as well.
The minority report, Mr.
Minority. Actually, there are many good things in that report that I think will advance the ball substantially. Great. This one, which just came up the morning of the hearing in Commerce, this was not discussed throughout the summer or fall, this restriction on 90 days. This just came up at the committee hearing to me.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, I will say that that was discussed, and we can look on the matrix and see. We had a matrix that we used to make sure that people understood and knew what topic and what conversation we were going to have during that meeting.
All right.
What was new? Uh-huh. What was new is when we turned it into language. Mm-hmm. And I think what you're seeing here is why these issues are so complicated and difficult. I'm sitting between two groups that have an interest.
Uh-huh.
Have an interest in this and how it works out and how it plays out. Now, I've met and talked with Mr. Carlson about some of the concerns when it comes to other offenses and how that might be portrayed. I haven't seen any language or change, proposed language change to this particular section of this. What we looked at and what we talked about and discussed at length was where does the consumer fall in when it comes to the solicitation of flyers that come to you when you get in an accident? And what did we feel about that when it came to our legislation that we currently had, and could we make changes to this that would help that situation? So if the suggestion is that we need to change this language, which I know that did come up in the working group, and it did come up in the hearing in Commerce, but I have not seen any proposed language changes as of yet.
All right. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Jensen and either Mr. Johnson or Mr. Carlson, if you want to comment. My recollection from the discussion was that the limitation for 90 days would apply to people who would not be considered directly interested parties, so the people who were parties to the accident themselves, potentially, and their agents, insurance agents, or lawyers, or something like that. So is there any clarity there that we can get to, perhaps? I'm not sure.
Senator Jensen, Mr. Johnson.
Excuse me. I mean, there is another statute that specifically deals with accident reports, and I don't remember the citation, but it actually, you know, it lists to whom the information on that is available, and it's the parties, their attorney, their provider, their insurer. So there's specific language that authorizes direct access, if you will, to that information.
So I'm sorry, Mr. Johnson. So just to be clear, so this language in this bill, I'm missing, where did I put it? Here we are. So this triggers the data to be public 90 days after it was created. How is the data classified then in that 90-day period? Is that like there's private, then there's confidential? Do we know? And I think,
Mr. Chairman, I'll step lightly in this because I am not an expert.
This is a judiciary conversation.
Data practices law, and we have learned that it's kind of a quagmire. I was working with the Senate Councils and the Senate Commerce Committee. The bill is originally drafted, did a series of deletions in another statute, and those deletions didn't accomplish the goal of trying to make this information non-public, because this statute makes the data in an accident report public. Mm-hmm. So in conversations with lawyers for the Department of Public Safety, just to understand the trail of the laws and how they work, this is the statute that needs to be amended vis-a-vis what's public on an accident report. So, and that's why Mr. Chairman from Senate Commerce moved away from the statute that they had put in their original bill, because this is the statute that needed to be impacted. So the objective was the same. It just needed to be accomplished in the right statute, and this was the conclusion where the statute that needed to be amended, if that's clear.
Okay.
Somewhat helpful.
All right. Council did help. So these reports would otherwise be confidential. This isn't another part of statute, except for a number of exceptions. I guess that's what except means. To the Commissioner of Public Safety or law enforcement, the individual involved in the accident, or a representative of their estate, another person injured, legal counsel, representative of the insurer, and other similar sorts of exceptions like that. So folks who do have an interest in information about the accident can gain access. It's just the general public cannot, and if this were to be enacted. Okay.
Mr. Chairman and
Mr.
members,
Crow.
I would respectfully disagree with that analysis, because Chapter 13, which governs that information, would supersede the release of the information until after 90 days. It's not that you couldn't get it at some point, but it's our read of this, because you're not amending 169. You're amending all data, and I I appreciate that is a quagmire, but accident reports under the Data Practices Act are public data. The information under 169 allows them to be released so long as they do not include private data on individuals. And if you keep going, like in other areas of law, the Department of Public Safety sells that information in bulk to people like Crash Facts and lawyers and to providers and others who use that list for various reasons, including marketing, just like the insurance companies. I have my stack of letters just like everyone else does. It's a First Amendment free right speech to advertise. That's not a problem. What I want to link up is fraud with the information, and we've talked about it, but we haven't seen convictions. We haven't seen arrests. Let's bring the prosecutions before you take this step and deny people right to information that they need. And that is our major concern about this change, which I believe supersedes the provision in 169 because it starts with government data. That's how I'm viewing it, and that's how we're viewing it. I could be counseled otherwise, but it starts with Chapter 13.
All right. Questions, members? I do have one other testifier on the list, Tom Lynch, Director of Government Affairs, National Insurance Crime Federation. Is he here? Nope.
He's good.
All right. He's good. All right. Other questions, members? All right. Do we have a motion? Senator Jensen, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Westrom, I didn't see you.
Just Mr. Chair, where's the pathway to this? Is it in the judiciary or the floor? Or?
Nope. Senator Westrom, it'll go to state and local next. And then it'll go to judiciary, and then it'll go to finance, and then rules. Right. And at some point, it'll hit the floor after 3+ stops in committee before then.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd have some concerns. So I'm with what's been told to us. So I'm assuming there'll be some work on potentially or Senator Jensen. Is this the final bill you want, or is there some issues you anticipate working on yet, or what's kind of the disposition, do you think?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, there was some concern on this section and one other that I'm looking at some language and working with everyone. So when we get – and they do primarily have to do with judiciary. So I'm hoping that it will be, by the time it gets to judiciary, we will have – this worked out.
All right. Thank you. All right. Senator Jensen, a motion.
Mr. Chair, members.
Yes. I move that Senate File 2372 be recommended to pass and be referred to the State and Local Government Committee.
All right. Any questions on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes. Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we have two bills to present, Senate File 2614 and Senate File 2616. They're both unsession bills. The reason they're split into two is because 2614 has three provisions that are essentially a change in policy, perhaps an improvement in the vein of unsession, the spirit of the unsession a set of ideas. And then 2616 has a number of repealers, obsolete, unnecessary, redundant provisions. And so we decided to travel them separately just because they felt a little bit different from each other, so we thought we'd put them under different jackets. You know that thing where the author says, I'll refer the presentation of the bill to the guy sitting next to me? I'm going to do that thing. So So 2614 has those three provisions, like I said, and there's someone more qualified than me to represent those thoughts and ideas and explain them. And I'll sit here. I'll try to
Mr.
field
Dane.
Any questions that I can.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Dibble. Senate File 2614, the first two sections of that bill amend statute to remove the current one-mile limitation on highway construction in an adjoining state. This will give the department more flexibility to work with bordering states to best arrange projects. The adjoining state would still obviously pay for the work that's done within their state, but oftentimes it makes more sense to do the work under one contract rather than having each state have a separate contract. And likewise, an adjoining state would be allowed to oversee work done within Minnesota. A couple of years ago, the department got an exemption from the one-mile limitation for a specific project on Highway 60 in southwest Minnesota, where MnDOT oversaw a contract that involved work in the state of Iowa. So the change in this bill will provide flexibility for Minnesota and neighboring states to arrange a project in the optimal manner without the need for special legislation for each project. The changes in Section 3 add natural phenomena and man-made disasters to the exemption that allows a one-week advertisement for bids. It also adds a provision that allows work to prevent damage rather than the current system where the damage actually has to occur first. And then finally, it removes the requirement to mail advertisements for these types of contracts since the department now does all of its bid advertising on the web. MnDOT believes that this would be a useful tool for other things like preventing flood damage or even repairing flood damage, as it provides for a shortened advertising period for things that are an urgent need but not necessarily an emergency. And we do have separate statutory language for emergency contracts as well. And then finally, Section 4 of the bill provides that the state is not responsible for continuing to make payments to cities for bonds that they have issued if a city population falls below 5,000. As you probably know, the Minnesota Constitution restricts municipal state aid street payments to cities of 5,000 and above. Local agencies currently have the ability to use state aid funds to pay the principal and interest on bonds that they have issued for projects on the state aid system. And this statute's been in place for many years, but in any single year, only typically one or two cities out of about 230 that are eligible for municipal state aid street funding take advantage of this provision. And since this provision was enacted, cash balances in state aid accounts have been high enough to allow agencies to borrow against future allotments from the state aid system, state aid funds. And so by renewing that request, they can continue to build projects. Additionally, interest rates have been low enough that many agencies have chosen to bond based on their own financial position rather than using this mechanism. So that's a brief summary of the bill. We'd be happy to try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rudine. Senator Dibble, any additional comments?
No comments. I'll stand for questions, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Can we have Section 4 explained again?
Yep. Sure.
Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair and Senator Tomasoni, under current law, there's a provision that a city can use their state aid funds to issue bonds. And there was a situation with a couple of cities after the last census where they fell below 5,000 in population, but they had some of these outstanding bonds. And so then the question was, who is responsible to continue making those payments? Because the Constitution specifies that state aid payments can only go to cities above 5,000 in population. And so this is really, I should say that those instances that arose the last couple years after the last census were addressed in legislation last session. But we feel that for future years that it's important to have some language in the statute so that it's clear to the cities and also to the bond houses that if a population of a city falls below 5,000, that it is possible that they'll lose their municipal state aid street funding.
Madam Chair, are the cities that fell below and have used it, are they grandfathered in or are they in?
No. Madam Chair, perhaps we should have Rick Jonas from our state aid office come up and help respond to this question.
Welcome, Mr. Jones.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rick Jonas, and I'm a previous deputy state aid engineer of MnDOT. I'm going to be retiring in a month, so they've got a special title for me now. I'm not even sure if I know it myself. But I have managed the program for the last 12 years. And in the case of the 2010 census, there were five cities that fell below 5,000 population. One of those five cities had sold bonds for a period of 15 years, and I think they still had about 12 years due and payable. And the legislature did take action and gave tremendous guidance. We've had problems after the 1980, 1990, and 2000 census with similar issues and had to take each of those decades and like it's a brand new problem. The action that was taken by the legislature last year will give the guidance on how to handle the 2020 census and the 2030 census and every federal census beyond. That's tremendous advice. And the guidance is that a city that falls below 5,000 population will continue to get state aid for the next 5 years, giving them a soft landing period, allow them to complete projects that are already maybe underway or well into planning without being abruptly losing their funding source. And in a general sense, I might say complete their five-year plan. That most cities operate with a five-year plan. Now, the fact that they've got a bond and they've put improvements into their city and they've pledged this income, which is not really a secure income, as we have just evidenced, the way that the city intends to repay those bills, does not, nor has it ever, been made that an obligation of the state or the state aid office or MnDOT. Some have thought it made it the obligation, though, of the municipal state aid pool, and the other 146 cities should give up a little to help pay for those improvements in that town that they've already made. And it's pretty universally accepted that that is not how it should work. It is that city's obligation. And we've had a number of meetings. Fortunately, in the case of this city, it has climbed above 5,000 population in the demographer's estimate. So the problem has gone away. This is a good opportunity for us to get in here and clarify for anybody who didn't understand it before, like some of the bonding companies, that these are really local agency bonds where they have pledged a portion of their state aid income if they continue to get it as the way they're going to repay those bonds. But it is still a city obligation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Jones, how did we handle cities last year in over here? How did we handle cities last year in the 2010 election? How did we handle or the 2010 census? How did we handle cities from the 2000 census that may have fallen below 5,000?
Mr. Jones?
In the 2000 census, there was three communities, and we don't get the official census for about 2 years. So in 2002, we were notified after we already had given them their 2002 money. And then we took them off the rolls. So they just were out at that point in time.
So, Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, so I think what MnDOT is trying to accomplish is avoiding the situation where cities anticipate that they might be falling under 5,000, hurrying up and selling some bonds and trying to obligate the state then to the repayment of those bonds for the term. I think what the state has done in the past is as these cities, I mean, we wrestled with this a couple years ago. Some cities had, fell off the 5,000 threshold. That's that constitutional threshold to qualify for municipal state aid. And rather than just yanking them because they had done their planning and programming, they were given a soft landing, as Mr. Jonas had described, which is, pretty significant in light of the constitutional requirements, but not stayed on the hook to pay off bonds which they had obligated or had taken under obligation.
Mr. Jonas?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, I'd like to clarify that in each of these decades that we've had to wrestle with how to handle the soft landing, if any, and we gave none in the year 2000 except the 2 years it took to notify us that the city had fallen. This is the first and only time that we had a city that had outstanding bonds, and now because of declining population, vacant property, and now the loss of state aid, they were worried that they were going to be unable to pay their bonds, and so decided to at least make an effort to get the other cities of the state to help pay those bonds unsuccessfully.
What you're saying is that a city might be bonding based on the state aid that they're getting, and after the census, they are no longer at 5,000 and they no longer qualified for the state aid that they based the bonds on? Is that what we're saying?
Mr. Jonas?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, that's exactly what we're saying. It's happened once now in the last 40 years, just this last time. And fortunately, it's corrected itself as the city has climbed back up to 5,000 population and will still be receiving a state aid through the length of its bond, it appears.
Okay, I maybe need to talk to you about something then.
Senator Peterson and then Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, it does seem a little bit unfair on the surface here to kind of maybe yank the rug out from underneath those smaller cities. I mean, I think we all understand those smaller cities are in greater Minnesota have a declining population, and we're likely to have quite a few more in this scenario than what we've had at this point. Did you consider just leaving them in once they're in and they qualify, they were there? Because these bonds are what, typically 20 years or 30 years? Or
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is exactly why we put this bill under a separate cover than this other bill, because I figured it would trigger this conversation. Let me just say that this is the agency bill, and I didn't change the proposal as the agency brought it forward. But I think, I'll let the agency speak for itself, but my reaction is that I think the concern is that it would create a perverse incentive for cities that feel like they're under threat of losing their population to quickly issue bonds and then keep the state on the hook for their state aid payments, their municipal state aid payments, even if they fail to qualify. For an additional, I guess they're 15-year bonds. This statute would make it clear that municipal state aid cities, if they're riding on the cusp, need to step carefully if they're going to be issuing bonds, if they're going to be bonding against anticipated future payments out of the Trunk Highway Fund, because, those aren't necessarily guaranteed. I mean, I don't know that this language would cause the state to continue to be obligated to pay those bonds, because that is a constitutional requirement. We can't change the Constitution here, but it would just send a clear signal in the statute that you need to step carefully if you're going to be issuing bonds against anticipated future payments from state sources. Otherwise, again, like I said, the perverse incentive would be to rush to sell bonds that may or may not have a strong foundation for repayment in the future. I mean, I don't know why bond houses would approve that sale in the first place. They usually do their due diligence, but I don't know. MnDOT can explain more, I guess.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just see that the only testifier we have on our paperwork here is the Department of Transportation. Have you heard of anybody else that's going to be testifying?
Madam Chair and Senator Peterson.
Mr. Dean.
We did meet with the League of Minnesota Cities, and we also separately shared this proposal with the, I believe they're called the Coalition of Small Cities, and they were both comfortable with this provision. I think they're actually both here in the room if you'd like to have them.
Great, thank you.
Senator Westrom, you had a question?
Madam Chair, I guess from the department, or Senator Dibble, whoever wants to answer this, you mentioned we'd give them a 5-year soft landing, and that's 5 years after the 2 years that it takes to take the census, so you'd be talking 2007 instead of 2002. Yet the Constitution is what dictates the cities that can get it, and that's 5,000 over 5,000. How do we square that? If we're paying the cities that now fall below 5,000 for two or 5 years beyond, and then I think I just heard you say now that this current situation might correct itself because they're going to be above 5,000 in the future, but we've got 10 years of them below 5,000. Can you square all these little?
I think Mr. Jonas.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you.
And pieces.
Chair. I think Mr. Jonas can square it a little bit. I actually think okay. The situation he's describing is more recent than that. The 2002 situation, I don't think they were given a soft landing. I think it was the more recent census, this particular okay. city.
But either way, I frankly don't know
the answer to your question about, you know, I think we just decided to go ahead and do that because we're soft-hearted and kind people. But Mr. Jonas can help.
Mr. Jonas.
The history of what happened after the 2010 census was we gave the money to the five affected cities in 2011 and in 2012 because we were without the knowledge that the population had changed yet. The census became official during 2012, and there was discussion at the legislature, but we did not get any directions. So in 2013, we did not give money to those five cities because we had no authority to do so. Then the legislature took action and decided to give guidance for that situation and to all future legislators when the federal census is done in 2020 and 2030. And I think that was an excellent decision to give that guidance now forward. We won't be in limbo.
And when was that guidance? Last spring?
It was two sessions ago. We were given it so that we were able in 2014, then, because it's a five-year soft landing is what the legislature directed. It says that you should get your state aid until one more year after a year ending in a four is how the wording of the statute is. Hmm. And so that to me means 2015. So in 2014, we gave those five cities a double dose to make up for not having given them money in 2013. And then we were preparing to give them money in 2015. And then unless the state demographer or Met Council tells us that the population is now estimated above 5,000, we'll cease to give them money in 2016. But we've already been given direction that most of the five cities have reached 5,000. That decision is made, and I think it was a good decision. Everybody seems to like it. It's one that we could administer. It will work well in 2020. And all of that is not really subject of this bill. The subject of the bill is if a city, even with the soft landing, after the soft landing, still has bond obligations for which they pledge their state aid money to help them repay, they feel that the other cities should have to help pay their bond off. And we have never administered the program with that interpretation. And we have taken steps now that if you're under 6,000 population, we're going to carefully scrutinize whether you're climbing or declining before we issue the bonds. But in an effort to administer that policy, we have found out that the cities and the bond councils don't often even inform us of the bond until the bonds are sold. We are not a party to the bonds, and with that belief, our legal counsel has suggested it would be good to put in statute, too, that those bonds are not the obligation for state aid to administer by taking it away from the other cities. It never has, never will be. It's a clarifying of our legal opinion that's been given to our office concerning bonds. The soft landing part was taken care of last session.
So, Madam Chair, a few different questions. Do you know offhand what the five cities are we're talking about and the three cities from 2000?
I would be able to get them, I think, fairly
quickly. Mr. Jonas.
Circle Pines, Byron.
Thank you. I have another question, Madam Chair, while you're looking, I could ask in the
Senator
interest
Westrom.
Of time.
Byron, Circle Pines, Dayton, La Crescent, Medina.
Medina?
Medina.
Okay. So,
Senator Westrom.
Madam Chair, just to the question I had, how does this square with the Constitution? If we're limited under the Constitution to 5,000, and let me just bear with me here, because here's what's going through my mind. If we flow it out 5 years, I don't exactly know how that's, and I haven't studied the constitutional language. Maybe it says the legislature shall give direction and decide when the 5,000s. But if we're using the state or the federal census as the benchmark or the guidepost, then I've heard you talking that there's also state demographer numbers that you can go back and look at. So why would we not use the state demographers every year or every 2 years? If we're using them on one end and not on the other, why wouldn't we just use them all the time and then we'd know more precisely, more real time when somebody's above 5,000 or below? Because this can work both ways. Cities can go above 5,000 and then all of a sudden qualify for some windfall that they've never had. I mean, so you understand where I'm going with the question? Why are we using the state demographer in part of the situation, but other times not? And how does this square with the Constitution? It doesn't seem to me on its face that we would have the authority to just rewrite what the Constitution directs.
Mr. Jonas?
Madam Chair, Senator Westrom, our office, MnDOT State Aid Office, does receive an estimate from the state demographer and from the Met Council every year, and every year we adjust the number of state aid cities within the state. We add cities if they've gone above 5,000, and we subtract cities. Well, we don't take them off based on the demographers. We only take them off based on a federal census. So that's why that kind of clusters up to the census. We got five this last go-around. And I heard many of the arguments when you abated the bill about the five-year landing that you're talking about. How can we provide for a landing in light of what the Constitution says? But those were arguments for that bill that was passed last session. The bill that is here before you today is, as we've asked you to help us to clarify and send out our message, which we plan to follow at the advice of our general counsel, that if you're not receiving state aid is not going to pay your bonds for you by taking it away from the other state aid cities. We never have done that. Mm-hmm. We never anticipate doing that. But there is at least a few people that think that we should. And so we've asked for help in clarifying our position on these bonds.
So Madam
General obligation bonds of the city.
Right. So, Madam Chair, and to that
Senator
point,
Westrom.
I mean, it seems to me on its face logical that the city entered into the bonds knowing that that's always a risk that could happen. It would probably come out of their own coffers. Is that the logical place that it is or should be coming out of to the witness?
Mr. Jonas?
Madam Chair, that is completely MnDOT's position, and I think the other cities would feel that it would be unfair to ask them to pay for the bonds of another city for a project and an improvement done within that city.
So, and lastly,
Senator Westrom?
Madam Chair, you kind of addressed this, but it was an idea going through my head. I thought, why, you know, when their census gets closer under, say, 6,000, that ought to almost be an additional checkpoint that's looked at when you're paying out the aid to the cities or giving them some notice to say, hey, don't be caught by this scenario if your population drops below 5,000 and you're obligated, you're going to have a backup plan. So it sounds like you've already kind of started addressing that. Did I hear that right?
Mr. Jonas?
Madam Chair, Senator Westrom, yes, your advice and your thoughts are right on, and we're making every effort. As I've mentioned, for some reason, we don't even get told about these bonds that are being considered until after they're sold in some cases. So we are looking for ways to intervene. One of the ways we intervene is we do actually train the bonding companies on how they should work with MnDOT. Mm-hmm. And we've added this to the curricula to try to get the bond companies to realize the risk of selling state aid bonds in a city that is in a declining population situation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Dibble, that flows right into my question. By adding subsection 4, when cities are going and letting bonds, they look at their bond rating and they look at a number of factors. And by putting in subsection or in section 4, you're probably adding some instability to the equation that the bond issuers are going to have to accommodate through probably a change in the interest rate, because the instability means you probably have more risk, meaning there's going to be a higher bond or a higher percentage. Do we have any indication that that is going to take place, or is there any indication on the impact of what a city can expect if they're in this situation, that they're going to be paying a premium, a 10%, 25% type of impact to their bond, their percentage on their bond?
So,
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Jonas says he has the answer. I'll see if I can take a stab at it. I actually think it might present a little more clarity at the point at which the bonds are sold, because this actually doesn't change the facts. You know, you can't obligate these MSA dollars for 15 years if you're not going to be getting them. And so I think it will introduce a level of clarity. But I don't know. Mr. Jonas probably has a better answer.
Mr. Jonas.
Madam Chair, by golly, the senator is correct.
Congratulations.
Additional part, though, is if it should happen that somehow in the process the message doesn't get totally understood by either the salesman representative of the bonding company and the city, and somewhere there's an impression that this is really is a responsibility of the state, and perhaps even bondholders could get notified incorrectly, that would be unfortunate, because that's not true representation. This will help to prevent bonds from being sold as if it's the fate of the state that is going to repay those bonds. It's the general obligation of the city. And that's the situation that we were actually kind of dealing with the last couple of years.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni?
This one has always bothered me, because you can have 5,001 or 5,000, but if you have 4,999, you don't get the aid. And the issue is that this size city probably has a state aid road that goes through it, which is how they get the state aid money. And so they, in 2008, they bond for a section of road going through the city, and in 2010, when they take the census, they drop below 5,000. And in 2011, they have four more babies, and all of a sudden they're above 5,000 again. Do they get the aid or don't they? How do you, 1 year they're not getting the aid, next year they're getting it, but they got the bonds hanging out there? Because I think the small city that has just dropped below 4,000 or below 5,000 who previously qualified will say it's unfair to them that they're not getting the money because they did something based on what the law was. I don't think we should actually do this, if you want to know the truth. I think we should remove Section 4, because if this is an unsessioned bill, that's a pretty controversial section, if you ask me.
Senator Dibble?
Well, whatever is the pleasure of the committee, I actually think this is a good section to keep in, because I think it clarifies what's already the case, so that cities can be clear. I mean, everything that Senator Tomasoni said is true. It's not changing policy. It's changing the clarity of the law around existing policy as expressed in the Constitution. So that's my view, but whatever the committee thinks is the wisest way to proceed.
Yeah, I'm sure I'd move to remove Section 4, just because I think if we find out that I'm wrong, we can put it back in. But I think this is – I think it goes too far here. Sounds like we did something last year that addressed this already, and this makes it way too definitive as far as I'm concerned, and so I would like to take it out. I would hope the author would agree with me, too, because when you got a real lot of small cities that are around this population in your district, that's a very touchy point, and so right. trying to figure out how they manage, because quite frankly, when they're relying on the state aid to pay for a bond like this, and then they lose the money, I don't know where they get the money from, and that's the other part.
Well,
Senator Dibble.
Senator Thompson, that's exactly the point. They shouldn't be relying on the state aid money if they're about to lose it and they're aware that they're about to lose it.
How do you know that you're going below 5,000 when you take a bond out 2 years before the census is taken?
Well, Senator Dibble.
Senator Thompson, that's what city managers and city leadership does, is they take a look at their population trends and what kind of dollars they're obligating, so they have some clear sense. I mean, they're not going to be able, Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, they're not going to be able to obligate those dollars for the life of the bonds if they drop below 5,000 at the next federal census. So if they're issuing bonds, a year or two before the federal census comes on, and they're right on the bubble there, they're running a risk, and they should just do that with open eyes. They're going to rely on those state aid dollars, and those state aid dollars go away. Now, the legislature did a couple years ago say, okay, well, this is a bad situation, and these five cities are in a bad circumstance, so we'll let them have their money for another 5 years so they can figure out a transition plan. And then we gave that same, made that same decision for the 2020 and the 2030 census. But we didn't do it for a decade and a half. The other side of the coin, of course, is that, this is a limited pot of money, so anything that goes to a particular city is taken away from the other cities that are in that pool. So that's just my perspective, but the motion. I speak against it.
Senator Tomasoni has made a motion. Any further discussion? Senator Sinjum and then Senator Westrum.
It seems to me a couple of years ago I had one city in my district, Byron, and another one in the region, Caledonia, kind of caught in this where the demographer had their population, above that 5,000. They had projects, and the census comes along, and it's not what they thought it was. And then, of course, they talk to their legislator, and they come up here and plead their case and try to make something work in a sort of an abbreviated way. But I think it's always going to be that way, and maybe it should be that way. Every case is a little bit different. I'd support Senator Tomasoni's amendment.
Senator Westrum.
Madam Chair, I'm going back to one of the points I made, and the question on the demographer, is there a reason we only use the demographer's data to let people in and not exclude them? To the DOT gentleman.
Mr. Jonas.
Madam Chair, yes. Historically, state aid, who I think the first time we had to deal with this issue was after the 1980 census. And then every year we get in July a estimate for either from the state demographer or from Met Council, and we also rely on the advice of the municipal screening board, which works closely with the city engineers who share in that pool of money. And through discussion, it's been decided that the demographer's estimates based on building permits and annexations can be used to add cities to the being eligible, but not to take away, that we would not take a city off the rolls until we actually had a federal census to justify taking a city off of the rolls. And that's been how we've operated for all these years. And now we've got the guidance from the legislature that when the federal census takes you off, you still continue to get money through the a total of five years after the census was taken. That so makes for good planning. That was good guidance. And
Senator,
I just try to repeat that we feel a need to try to clarify what has not been interpreted by all the way our MnDOT General Counsel does, that if a city sells the bonds, even if they pledge their state aid income, they are in fact revenue bonds, general obligation of the city. And if anybody has represented them as obligations of the state, that is not correct. And we've asked for the legislature's help in getting that message out so that nobody gets hurt.
So, Senator Western.
Madam Chair, in the process, then, it's possible for a city that's, whatever, 5,000, 10,000, 6,000, and you add somebody else, that their pool of funds would go down. Have you ever had a scenario where you've guessed wrong and they come in, the city that you've allowed all of a sudden comes in at 4,900 instead of 5,100 or over 5,000?
Mr. Jonas?
Yes, most of these five cities here were added in the early 2000s before the Depression. The state demographer estimated they had gone above 5,000, and they may well have been in 2003 above 5,000. But after 2008 and some foreclosures and some relocation of people and whatnot happening, mm-hmm. when the 2000 census got done, those cities were not 5,000, and so we were forced to take them off. They had never been above 5,000 based on a federal census. They were only above 5,000 by an estimate. But this wasn't also with this unfortunate set of situations that we had the economic decline in 2008 that I think was a big factor.
And so to Senator Tomasoni's amendment here, if we take this out, what I understand from the authors and in your testimony is we're taking out clarifying language that MnDOT is asking to point to and set in motion or set straight the process that's going to happen. If this language is out, the same outcome is what's currently being counseled and advised to cities, but it leaves some ambiguity in there, and potentially somebody could sue for the obligation. Is that basically where we're at?
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I don't know the answer, Senator Westrom, to your final question, but to the first part of your question, yes, nothing will actually change if Section 4 comes out.
And Council, I believe, had some comments to make on this subject as well.
Madam Chair and Senator Westrom, I just wanted to add to what Mr. Jonas said, that the statute at 162.09 subdivision 4, it provides, first of all, the basic rule that in determining a city's population, the last federal census is conclusive, but then there's a number of exceptions to that. And a city can, they can have a special census taken at its own expense. The city can request that the Metropolitan Council or state demographer estimate its population. And whatever that, if those estimates or that special census puts the city back in the over 5,000 category, statute actually provides that is deemed to be the population of that city until the next federal decennial census or special census.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Further discussion on Senator Osmek.
Madam Chair, Ms. Brzozowski, sorry if I'm not pronouncing that correctly. So what you're saying is that Section 4 actually would be a poison pill that would supersede or would impact the statutory language that you just provided. It would say that we say that if the feds say less than 5,000, you're not getting the money. Is that a correct view of the situation?
Ms. Berezovsky.
Madam Chair and Senator Osmek, I'm not sure if I agree with exactly the way you phrased it, but I do think there is some ambiguity or lack of clarity as to how these provisions work together.
Further questions on the Tomasoni amendment? Further discussion? All right. All those in favor of the Tomasoni amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The amendment is adopted.
I was in control of my committee here.
No, I think you're aye. Yeah. It wasn't recorded.
Further discussion on the bill? Questions? Senator Westrom.
Madam Chair, I got another question. Under Section 3, we're removing the notice requirement for to notify interested contractors if there's a rush bid. Can you explain why we're taking away that notice, and do we have an email update service that could replace that? I just get a little concerned if we're going to, one, shorten the bid period, and two, then not give notice to contractors that we know are in that business and have asked to get updates or want to be on a list. Why would we take them off, take that requirement that they give them a notice out? And I'm not opposed to getting rid of the paper notice, but then it seems to me we should at least have a more sophisticated email notice or something that's very, very easy to do.
Mr. Radin?
Madam Chair and Senator Westrom, I think you've already hit upon it. We no longer use paper bids, and we don't mail advertisements out anymore. This is just a relic from the days when we did. We do advertise all of our bids on the internet, and people can sign up for email services so that they're notified about all the bids. So striking this language does not mean that we're not providing the notice. It just means that we're no longer required to use U.S. mail for that activity.
So,
Senator Westrom?
Chair, Mr. Rodine, what would be in place so we know at least contractors are able to subscribe and get alerts when there's short windows for bids? Other than just policy, it seems to me we want something so in 10 years when some of us maybe, when maybe we're, none of us are here and you're maybe not even there, there's still a guiding statute or process so people are getting that notice.
Mr. Dean?
Madam Chair and Senator Westrom, there is language in that same subdivision that talks about upon advertisement for bids, mm-hmm. and there's a separate section of statute that describes the process for bid advertising for trunk highway projects. So I think if we looked at that language, that would provide you some comfort that we are required to provide public notice for all bids.
So Madam
Senator
Chair,
Westrom.
Mr. Rodine, even though we narrow the window to 1 week for submitting bids, there's still going to be email alerts and services or alerts to contractors. I assume they have to contact you or sign up on the website to be added to the list, but that will absolutely continue?
Mr. Rudin?
Yes, Madam Chair, Senator Westrom, it will absolutely continue. And even if they're not on an email list, they can always go to the website where these bids are posted as well.
And Madam Chair and Mr.
Senator
Rudin,
Westrom?
My only nuance with that would be at least a lot of the small businesses I represent, I mean, they're sometimes skeleton crews, and there's, you know, they're not big. They don't have lots of staff, and so alerts are a lot easier to be notified than to be sitting in the office when you're supposed to be out changing oil in the trucks or whatever it is. So that would be my concern. I raise that so we are making it as likely and as easy as we can for the small businesses so we can also solicit bids, because more bids brings better competition, and I don't want to have a default or an unintended consequence here. So if that's an issue, I'd like us to just clarify that so we make sure that they get notice, because a notice in the mail does the same thing as an email. Posting on the website isn't the same as everybody getting a notice in their mailbox. It'd be just like, you know, we don't consider due process just because somebody put something on the website. So can we look at that just to make sure that we're not bypassing an alert?
Madam Chair, Mr. Westrom, perhaps I can visit with you after the committee and go through the other statute with you. And certainly it's the department's interest to always have as many bids as we can get. So that's our interest as well.
Very good. Thank you.
And Mr. Dean, I think you did say that there is a listserv that people have signed up for. So they will get notification.
Yes.
Thank you. Additional questions or comments on the bill? Senator Dibble, would you like to make a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate file number 2614 as amended.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion adopted.
All right. Madam Chair, we have in front of us
Madam Chair, we have in front of us Senate File 2616, which is the bulk of the unsession provisions dealing with obsolete, unnecessary, or redundant provisions. There's a lot of them. And so I'll ask Mr. Rudin to go through those as quickly as possible. There's some conforming changes then in Article 2 as well that deal with some of the items that need to be conformed if provisions in Article 1 are acted favorably upon by this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Rudin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As Senator Dibble mentioned, this is the department's on-session bill, and a large part of Governor Dayton's on-session theme is trying to get rid of these obsolete or redundant or unnecessary statutes so that those statutes that remain on the books are easier to find and understand for the general public. So I'll try to do this quickly. There are a lot of provisions here. Article 1, Section 1.
Excuse me, Mr. Dean. Senator Rest?
Mr. Dean, do you think you could just give us a 20,000-foot view rather than going through dozens of provisions? And if members have questions about them, they can look over the bill and ask you?
I'd be happy to do that.
I just think that we don't really need. I don't need it. I don't know whether the rest.
Madam Chair, just
Senator Rest,
I get a general sense from the committee.
I'm seeing consensus around the table.
All right.
So,
just a 20,000.
Mr. Rudin,
20,000.
Just generally.
Certainly. All right. So maybe what I'll do, Madam Chair, is go through the bill a little bit backwards. Article 2, as Senator Dibble mentioned, are just conforming technical changes that were recommended by the reviser of statutes. So I don't think we really need to spend any time on those. Section 22 of the bill is the whole section of repealers, and you have in the bill the language that's actually being repealed, so there are no real substantive amendments or anything, obviously, to that whole section of the bill, but just repealing language that, in the department's view, is again, obsolete, outdated, and no longer necessary. And I should just maybe say that we did reach out to interest groups, you know, the railroads, the rail labor union, local government, and anybody we could think of who would be interested in these provisions, just to make sure that they agreed they could be repealed. And so what you have in the bill in Section 22 are provisions that, as far as we know, everybody is comfortable with deleting. So that leaves Sections 1 through 21, and these are not just straight-out repeals in some cases. For example, in Section 1, there's a requirement in statute that we report on jobs created by state bond projects. It's been difficult to apply that provision to small, very small state aid projects like replacing a township culvert, and so we're just saying that that requirement does not apply to state aid projects under $5 million. Section 2, passenger rail review. You can see there are numerous other projects that are exempted from some additional review requirements, and so we're proposing to exempt passenger rail projects. Sections 3, 4, these are just some obsolete language, so we're not repealing an entire subdivision there, but just some old language that's no longer necessary. Section 5, these are the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act reports. That program is pretty much wrapped up, but there's still this reporting requirement, and so we're just proposing to delete that. Sections 6 and 7, 8, 9, 10 are all, again, some old obsolete language. Section 11 is another reporting requirement to the legislature that we're proposing to delete of. These are called special revenue fund or partnership agreements, and some of these are for very small dollar amounts. Section 12 of the bill allows all department reports to the legislature to be submitted electronically. 14 is to eliminate a special transportation service provider report to the legislature. Section 15 changes the Safe Routes to School report from every year to every other year. 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20 are all obsolete provisions, and then Section 21 is another reporting requirement that we're proposing to delete on construction spending.
Members, any questions or comments on Senate File 2616? Senator Senjum, then Senator Westrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wonder if you could just, I'm in Article 1, Section 1, and it has to do with this, you know, the amount of jobs that certain investments would create. And, you know, it just seems like I've been around here for long enough to know that as transportation projects or even transportation advocates come along, it's all about we got to fix our roads and it's going to create so many jobs. And so there was an appetite around here for some time about, well, you know, is it 20,000 jobs or is it 2,000 jobs? And, like, you know, those numbers get thrown around, you know, pretty loosely. And so we put into statute this report about job creation relative to not only these to transportation projects, but also bonding projects. When you look at a $5 million project, I mean to me, I that still creates some level of substantial job creation around the state as we have these, and I suspect we have a good number of $5 million projects during the course of any year. Is that generally correct, or, I suppose the question might be, Madam Chair, how many of these approximately might we have around Minnesota in a given year? $5 million kinds of projects, or under $5 million, I guess it is.
Mr. Dean?
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, I'm not sure I have a number for you today. We could probably look that up and get that to you.
And Madam Chair, it's not important, but is it 100 or is it 5? Or what might you think?
Madam Chair, if I had to guess, I would say it might be in the dozens, in the range of dozens for some of these state aid projects that, for example, are replacing a township a bridge with a culvert. That might be a project that's in the range of a few $100,000.
Okay.
And so it has been, this provision has been in effect now, and it's been difficult on some of those very small, like township projects, to even estimate the amount of work because it might be, a half a day project where they're going in and putting in a culvert.
Madam Chair, that's helpful. Thank you.
Senator Westrom.
Madam Chair, Section 15, changing from an annual report to a biannual report on safe routes to school. How long have we had this in statute, and what do those reports, what do we get out of them? Could we do without them all together, or what's going to be the effect of going to every other year? What would change in 1 or 2 years?
Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair and Senator Westrom, I believe that this reporting requirement is fairly new and that we've so far only submitted one of these annual reports to the legislature. But there was a feeling in the department, at least, that there hasn't been enough activity in this program to really justify an annual report, and that even submitting a report every other year, you'd still get a good picture of what has happened in the program over that two-year window. So if there is a change in direction and the legislature suddenly provides, you know, a great deal of additional funding for this program, then, you know, at some point in the future it might be more appropriate to have an annual report. But the number of projects that have been undertaken so far has been very small, and so we didn't feel it was necessary to submit an annual report.
So,
Senator Westrom.
Madam Chair and Mr. Rodine, on this issue, it's only a few school districts that have to do this if they've gotten dollars that have been targeted towards improving or making a route safer to school, or does every school district have to provide these reports, or is it MnDOT that provides the reports?
Mr. Rodine.
Madam Chair and Senator Westrom, MnDOT actually provides the report, but we would we would look for that information from the school district or the city or whatever entity it was that received the grant to do the Safe Routes to School project. But it would only be those communities that received funding that would have to provide the information.
Madam Chair and Mr.
Senator Westrom.
I mean, it seems to me to make sense to go to every 2 years. I might even think we could go further out than that. But anyways, thanks for the clarification. Another question. I didn't hear you talk about getting rid of the un-session or any obsolete language about the speed limit. And I'm wondering if you're repealing anything with the horse and buggy speed limit we've had, and if we're replacing that with any updated language, say 60 miles an hour or anything like that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Westrom, you'll be happy to know there actually is a speed limit provision in the bill. There is. Maybe I should have kept my mouth shut.
They've
got a bridging amendment.
But there was. This was actually, I believe, recommended by the State Patrol. It's repealing Section 169.16 in Section 22, Subdivision 7 of the bill. There is language currently in statute that relates to speed limits on bridges and gives the commissioner authority to set separate speed limits on bridges. But, you know, bridges are part of the road system, and we have never used that authority. We don't establish separate speed limits on bridges. This probably is a relic from the days when a bridge was a dangerous thing to cross on a vehicle, and we would have had a separate speed limit there.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Rodine, that sounds like a good start, and we just forgot the rest of the roads. Is that the problem here?
Mr. Rodine.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Looks like a good place for an amendment, Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Senjum.
Yeah. Could I ask maybe for Senator Westrom's interest as all, is that would I also count the bridge on 35E leaving St. Paul? We could work on that a little bit. Not a question.
I see no hands. Any additional questions or comments on the bill?
Yeah.
Senator Dibble, would you like to make a motion?
Absolutely. Sure.
Madam Chair, I'll move Senate File 2616 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. Back. Finance.
To finance?
Finance.
Yes. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes.
Poof.
And with that, the meeting is adjourned.
That was heavy lifting.